right now there's a tremendous amount of regulatory uncertainty in the space. And so people are like, what's legal, what's not, what's the rules to the game, don't know, I'm scared, I'm going to invest someplace else. And so a lot of the product manufacturing opportunities aren't fully mature yet, which would drive more capacity requirements and like on the side of fiber and grain. And so until the regulatory murkiness is resolved.
Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hemp Association. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about the opportunity to build a relationship and connect this supply chain. I mean, after all, that's why we started the association. Our association was built on the foundation of connecting supply chain, building relationships, and helping you grow your business. Anyone from farmers, manufacturers, and distributors, people that are passionate about the supply chain, and those creating products selling into biofuels, plastics, textiles, construction, and building materials. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining. Patrick, welcome back. I'm excited about what we have going on. I always get tied up in conversation before we go live and want to just dive in. But I'd love real quick for those that don't know you, before we give the mic over to Bo, a little introduction about what you have going on and what's new, and then how do people get involved? And then we'll pass it over. And Bo, if you don't mind giving yourself an intro, of course, after Patrick's done.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good transition to have Bo on. Bo's with Whitney Economics, but he also serves as our chief economist. And I'll touch base on that a little bit later. But you asked, how do you get involved? You know, for us, is you join as a member. If you just want to try us out, we have a trial membership that you can, you know, come to us and try us out as an organization. What does that mean? You know, I was talking with my staff. We say, oh, you join, then what? One of those steps is signing up to be on one of our committees. We have an international market and trade committee. We have a government affairs committee. And then we have a standards committee that's talking about bringing, you know, certification and standardization and consistency to the industry. And we're having AOAC and ASTM at our meeting next week, Monday and Tuesday. And Mandy, we're very much looking forward to seeing you in person and our conversations there in the Global Hemp Association and how the National Industry Hemp Council can work in hand in hand with the GHA. So that step, one of the first steps is for, you know, you get what you put into it. And I'd highly recommend folks signing up for committees. How do you do that? You can either contact me, first initial P, last name Atagi. And how do you remember the Atagi? It's like the Atari video game, but with a G instead of an R. Atagi at hempindustrial.com. Or
that just aged all of us on here. Anybody that
well, it did, but you know, and you know, Amazon and you know, the retro games are pretty popular. Or G Johnson, Grace Johnson at hempindustrial.com. That's a little bit easier to remember. But you know, sign up as at our committees. The government affairs is growing, and the markets and trade, we just launched that. And so, you know, we need folks that we have market access program. Funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to do promotion, and there's some exciting things happening at our meeting, and we'll follow up after for those who can't join the meeting. But we're launching our magazine. We have a preview magazine for that. We'll look like we'll have hard copies out there. You know, for that we're having, you know, our trade, some great videos and international work that we're doing. But also say, you know, for those, you know, who might just be hearing about this, you know, you can register on site. We're at the Omni in Washington D.C. Up by the National Zoo. You know, we welcome that for those in Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Delaware, those, you know, West Virginia who are local. You know, feel free to come by, register. You know, you can use the our code if you're not a member, invited attendees, NIHC 2021. But no, we have a vast, you know, spectrum. Bo will be speaking there. You'll get to meet him in person. And, you know, I think that'd be really, you know, good for those interested in the statistical side of the information and data. I know Bo's presenting today, but, you know, he's also presenting, you know, information at our meeting, and, you know, he's continually available. And I'll put in a plug for Whitney Economics. You know, visit his website. He's got a lot of data and materials available. Just amazing. We're glad to be partnering with Bo and him serving as a face for the NIC. Like I said, we have academia, we have science, regulatory, ASTM, AOAC is presenting along with Food Safety Net Services. It's a who's who of government affairs people in Washington, D.C. You know, Mandy, you know, we were talking prior to the call about that. you know, you'll get to meet a lot of those folks. You know, we're really impressed with that side of the equation. It's just an outstanding, you know, go to hempindustrial.com to see the speakers. You know, again, if you're not able to be there, we'll be doing communications afterwards to let folks know what happened and the high, you know, the high marks of the information distributed. But extremely excited. It's really coming together. And I can't say anymore. Just the buzz is just great in DC, you know, and beyond. So with that, you know, Mandy, I'll lead you to it with Bo. Like I said, you know, of your speakers, you know, Bo is obviously, you know, in the top 1%.
That's right.
Yeah, he's amazing. I can't say enough. And he's an Oregonian like me, so that's even better.
That's awesome. Well, and Bo, right before we got on, we were talking about your reach and how much you're quoted. So I just have to give you big props at what you've done for this industry and the amount of knowledge and data you have. And so I'm excited to hear the presentation. And just to be clear, today's message will not be the same. So I hope everybody shows up to Bo's presentation again.
Because
this will be much more casual and different. So I'm excited to hear what's going on. But Patrick, thank you very much for joining. Yeah. I'm excited to see you then on Saturday and throughout the week next week. And anybody else that's going to be out there, let us drop us a note. Let us know. We'd love to set something up and definitely take some time to meet face to face and so forth. So thank you very much. And Bo, I'll turn it over to you. Thank you, Patrick.
You bet. Take care. See you in a couple of days, Bo.
Yep. See ya. So I'm Bo Whitney. I'm the founder and chief economist at Whitney Economics, a Portland-based research, data, and consulting firm. And we've been looking into the cannabis industry, adult use and medical at first for about 8 years now. And then we started diving into hemp based upon an invitation I had to speak at NOCO in 2017. And so started researching the economics of industrial hemp, and I was completely blown away. I had no idea. And the more that I dug into this, the more I realized how little data there was.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, for example, I was speaking at the Southern Hemp Expo, and at that time it was in Tennessee. And a lot of speculation was bantered about or as a result of the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill. And they're saying the narrative at the time was, hey, there's all of this supply coming online. It's going to overwhelm the processing capacity, and there's going to be too much supply, and there's going to be all this impact on the farmers. And so at that time I said, has anybody asked the farmers about what's going on? And there was silence. There was silence in the room. And so I was like, well, I'll ask them.
Yeah.
And so I put together a survey in 2019 and sent it out to over 10,000 farmers and directly and said, hey, what's going on? Tell me about your story. Tell me about your experience. Do you have a buyer? What are you seeing? What's your intention? And what I realized at that time is that 65% of the farmers that in the industry didn't have a buyer.
Yeah.
And so here they were planting this crop and not knowing who they were going to sell it to. And so, and that kind of opened my eyes. And so I started expanding my surveys, not only to the cultivation industry, but then to the processing industry. And so now I've been talking with product manufacturers. And so what I've been trying to do as a firm is I've been trying to map the value chain, starting from propagation and cultivation, and then from processing, and then product manufacturing. And there's been a lot of analysis done on the retail side of things. So I'll leave that to everybody else. And so, because I wanted to do a lot of the important work in terms of mapping out the value chain. So I dug into that. I've been doing that for a number of years now, taking one sector each season or each quarter or each year and taking a look at it and doing a deep dive. And some of the observations I have are a little bit counter narrative relative to others, other conversations. But I think that they're important nonetheless. And when I first started publishing my data on the survey results, I was in Portland, Oregon. There was an NIHC conference, and I ran into Patrick, and he said, "Wow, you're not even on the agenda, but your data is so important. Can you just speak extemporaneously about your findings, even pre-publication?" I said, "Absolutely." And so I jumped up on stage. I mean, there was, at that time, there was Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, the one of the heads of the USDA and the FDA. And then there's me. And so I really appreciated Patrick's willingness to put me up on stage and give me that forum and that voice. And that was really the beginning of my relationship with NIHC. Was just like, so there's been good collaboration with NIHC and me, and then I'm just delighted to be the chief economist there. Another aspect of this is that I couldn't do what I do without the support and participation of the farmers and the business operators and the investors in the space. And so I've been given a tremendous opportunity to have access to a lot of folks. And sometimes I'm amazed at the access that I have. But I'm really appreciative of that and their willingness to share the stories and the experiences about what's going on in the industry. So, so it's been an amazing ride over the last, 4 years or so, specific to the industrial hemp space.
It's pretty exciting. Okay. So of course I want to dive into some of these numbers when we talk about, what is the opportunity? And people say all the time, if hemp is so great, why don't we have it available? Why isn't it being processed like we all want it to be, right? Within our industry, and we're screaming and beating on the tables. But so talk to me a little bit about what do those numbers look like and what is that opportunity within the industry?
Well, I started looking at the capacity. A lot of discussion is around the demand by the consumer. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to look at how much demand can the industry supply. And so it kind of turned it around a little bit. And based upon the surveys from 2020 and 2019, I realized that there was all of this biomass inventory building up, especially for CBD. Fiber and grain was different, but CBD, there was just this massive amount. It was like a tsunami of inventory that came online. But when I surveyed the processors, they weren't running their machines. And I was like, well, if you have all this supply, then why aren't you running your machines 24/7? And the reason for that, I started poking at this. The reason for that is that there weren't product manufacturers placing orders into the processors. Mm-hmm. And so not a whole lot of that processed material was making it into the product manufacturing sector, mm-hmm. which in turn was not making it into the retail sector. Mm-hmm. And so although when I did talk to the retailers, they were like, yeah, our demand is going through the roof, 500%, 700% year over year growth, year after year after year. And so the demand was there, the products just weren't getting through. And so I started looking at that and realized that there was this often overlooked sector called product manufacturing. People talk about cultivation or propagation, about processing and retail, but people really aren't talking about product manufacturing. And product manufacturing, in my opinion, is the key to all of this. Once you get big manufacturers online, then a lot of this, in my opinion, a lot of this inventory will be consumed. It'll be processed and put into finished goods form. But until that point reaches, there's going to be this dearth of, or this massive amount of excess supply in the system. And so based upon surveys from last year, there was only 42% capacity utilization. So that means essentially processors were running their machines, 42% of the time.
Right.
That's like, that's not even, that's 2 shifts, 5 days a week.
Right.
So it's not very much.
Right. So when we speak about processing, right, what does the shift look like as we're really moving into the industrial manufacturing of, you know, biocomposites or biofuels? What does that look like, you know, as most of this has been CBD focused?
Yeah, sure.
Where are we now compared to the—
So early on, in after the passage of the 2014 Farm Bill, there was a lot of interest in grains and fibers. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the capacity, a lot of the acres that were planted were dedicated to fiber and grain. Mm-hmm. But then as CBD became in vogue, and people realized that there wasn't a whole lot of processing capacity for CBD, then everybody, and prices were going through the roof, then everybody started focusing in on that. Now that that opportunity has become overwhelmed by supply, and there's not enough products available to consume all that inventory, processors and cultivators are shifting over into the grain and the fiber space. And so now you're starting to see a decline in the percentage of acres associated with CBD and an increase in the percentage of acres associated with fiber and grain. And that's a good sign, because that shows, one, that the cultivators and processors are nimble, and that's, you know, characteristic of pretty much everybody in the cannabis space, right? Regardless of if it's adult use.
If you're not, you're not in it.
Yeah.
You've already come and gone, probably, if you're not nimble.
But it also shows that people are gravitating to where the opportunities are. And the opportunities, in my opinion, are so overwhelmingly in the area of fiber and grain processing and manufacturing that it makes the CBD pale by comparison. And okay. So there's a shift occurring, but the shift is occurring at kind of a snail's pace right now, because one, it takes a while to convert over from a CBD processing facility to a fiber processing facility. There's different technologies, different machinery and the like. It's expensive at times to convert over. But then also the market needs to build the demand. You're starting to get the supply capabilities, but the demand is still kind of in question for, at this point, for fiber and grain. And the reason I say that is that right now there's a tremendous amount of regulatory uncertainty in the space. And so people are like, what's legal, what's not, what's the rules to the game, don't know, I'm scared, I'm going to invest someplace else. And so a lot of the product manufacturing opportunities aren't fully mature yet, which would drive more capacity requirements and the like on the side of fiber and grain. And so until the regulatory murkiness is resolved, until there's greater clarity coming from the federal regulators, there's going to be this kind of uncertainty to the point where it's suppressing the growth of the industry. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I have to hurry and get myself off mute because I was taking notes while you were talking. So I don't know where I'm going and can come back to this. So earlier you'd mentioned the manufacturing, right? And the manufacturing piece that wasn't discussed or hadn't been discussed a lot in the CBD side, right? On the industrial products, where do you see big opportunity? You know, and what numbers, I guess, support that as far as, you know, when I say big opportunity, I look at like the textile space, biofuels, construction, or even energy sector in general, construction, building materials, and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. You're nailing all of the industries that I would state. But in addition to those, I would say in addition to textiles, which is starting to achieve cost parity right now, relative to cotton, or there are opportunities for cotton hemp blends. There's textile manufacturers and suppliers that are starting to look closely at hemp textiles. But there's also opportunities in the areas of construction with hempcrete, with flooring and siding, with building materials. There's also, and by the way, I've looked at the hemp flooring, and I want to do, my wife and I want to redo our main floor in our house with, mm-hmm. with hemp wood, right?
Yeah.
It's more durable, better quality. It's not as porous. I mean, it lasts longer, scratch resist. So there's really, it's not only an issue of being a replacement product, but there's a quality aspect to it. You know, so there's a lot of viability in the construction space. In addition to that, plastics are really relatively unknown when it comes to the industrial hemp application, right? So plastics, you could replace plastic bags, you could plastic bottles and the like. It just takes money to increase the capacity, and it takes some policy changes in order to do that. Now, some states are proposing legislation to ban plastic bags, or to insist upon sustainable products and the like. And that's a good first step, but there's a long way to go. So there's not only a regulatory element, but also a legislative element in addition to increasing the capacity within the manufacturing space. In addition, you've got plastics, right? But then you've got automotive. And right now, BMW, Mercedes, and other car manufacturers are using hemp in their construction of their vehicles. What Whitney Economics is forecasting is that as there's a move more towards green technologies and sustainable products, the automobile industry will utilize hemp in a much more substantial way than what we're realizing right now. It reduces the cost, it reduces the weight. And as there's a transition over on the vehicles to electric vehicles, which require batteries, then you want to reduce the weight of your vehicle to extend your battery life. Another aspect is that actually you can make batteries out of industrial hemp. Mm-hmm. And so they hold a stronger charge. They take less time. Yeah, and take less time to charge back up. And so there's technology that already exists that's just waiting to be deployed. And it takes a little bit of effort to get inserted into the product specifications. And so, you know, compliance and all that stuff, regulatory. But once you're there, then it could really catch hold and take off at an exponential rate. So those are just a few of many. I haven't even mentioned hemp for animal feed, hemp for human consumption and alike.
There's been very little talk about the sugar or the protein. I mean, we talk about the protein compared to like on a hemp heart, but what's actually being extracted and used for treatment in the medical industries, right, on the protein or the sugar side is just.
Yeah. In fact, I've looked at protein content grams per acre of hemp relative to all of these other, and not only that, but then the omegas in there too. And there's so much more protein content and omegas on a per acre basis for hemp than soy, corn, you know, even alfalfa, you know, for that matter, and peas, right? So let's just look at Impossible Burgers, right? So you got Impossible Burgers. They use peas as the main source of protein in that. Mm-hmm. So just think if you could substitute hemp for pea, increase your protein, your input costs are lower. It makes better economic sense from a manufacturing perspective to include hemp rather than using your peas as a source of protein. Or you could do a combination, right? So there's all of these opportunities that, and a lot of these stories about the potential of hemp that is not being conveyed to the general public, not being conveyed with the exception of groups, you know, like NIHC, because they have a tremendous reach on Capitol Hill, right? So you have conversations occurring via NIHC on the regulatory side and legislative side, but there needs to be more education on the benefits of hemp throughout this entire chain, consumers, regulators, legislators, and the like.
That's definitely our effort, right? And that's why we're hosting so many of these, is just exactly that, to help get the information out and help connect people. So thank you again for joining. And thank you everybody else for listening in. I have to give a shout out to a few people that are listening. Ryan, you've got a great question. Wondering about optimistic outlooks that you've seen, Bo, in regards to fiber grain and or CBD.
You're wondering about, I'm optimistic. But I'm not this massive cheerleader.
I like reality. Like, let's be real.
I gave a speech recently about hemp and other cannabis opportunities in Europe. And I was speaking in Berlin, and I talked to this gentleman, and he goes, "You gave a rather sobering update on what's going on." He goes, "There's so many cheerleaders out there, but you were just really realistic." He goes, "You know, for an American, you're not so bad." And I thought that was like, okay. So what I'm trying to convey is that he appreciated the realistic and yet even conservative estimates that I was putting out there. And and I think that resonated not only with the Germans in the audience at that particular conference, but it resonates with others that need a realistic baseline about what's going on in the industry. When I put together the forecast for fiber and grain, I look at these opportunities, textiles and construction and automotive. And then I look at what reasonably could occur in the short run. And then I look at market share conversions. How much market share can one take from cotton manufacturing or cotton production, or what would market share could be included in the automobile industry and the like. And then I generally cut that in half and then make my projections on those numbers. And what I'm trying to do that is to build in conservatism. Because even with those conservative numbers, the number of acres required is enormous. And so it doesn't take very much conversion in textiles and construction and animal feed to really blow up the number of acres required. I mean, by 2030, I'm projecting a demand for almost 10 million acres of hemp for cultivation, 10 million acres. Just think, I mean, last year there was roughly 500,000. This year there's 235,000 acres. So a decrease of almost 55% year over year in number of acres. But that's because people are exiting. They're not able to see the opportunities. They're not able to cover their costs. So they're exiting. And it's unfortunate because they're exiting out of the cultivation side at a time that the hemp industry is poised for significant growth. And so, but when you run out of cash, you run out of cash. And, I lay some of that onto the hands of the cultivators for not doing their due diligence about knowing where to sell this to and what the value chain looks like. But then I also lay some of the responsibility of that decline on the regulators themselves for not providing a supportive environment and instead providing a controlling environment. So it's unfortunate. But for those that have remained steadfast and have vision and have the means to do this, I think the opportunities for hemp in the cultivation and the processing, product manufacturing, there's a lot to that and there's a lot of potential.
Okay, so here's a really good question about 22. Any guesses on hemp? Any guess to hemp planting intentions for 2022? And then there was another question specifically asked, thank you, Drew, about the bottleneck, expected bottlenecks for 2022 on the fiber grain.
Yeah, sure. So there's been a decline of hemp processing capacity year over year. It increased last year by over 100%. And then now this year has declined. And that's because the processing side hasn't achieved its potential either. There hasn't been the orders being placed on the product manufacturing side. A lot of that decline is related to CBD. And so right now on fiber and grain, there's still a need for processing capacity. So in terms of bottlenecks, I still see the strong need for increased fiber and processing capacity, or fiber and grain processing capacity. And so that's where the bottleneck will occur. Now, so my firm just completed an assessment of all of the states and their hemp programs. And so we've looked, when we could get the data, we've looked at, you know, what percentage is fiber, what percentage is grain, what percentage is CBD. And you're starting to see this shift over to the fiber and grain side, and a decline in CBD acres licensed. Now, last year, 70% maybe in terms of CBD capacity. Actually, it was 82%. That's shifted way down. It's sub 60. And by 2030, I'm forecasting that CBD acre demand will be 2.5 to 3% of the total acres demanded. And so that shows how fast an ascension there will be on fiber and grain. Mm-hmm. And as a result, there will be corresponding demand for processing capacity, for decortication, degumming, all of that that goes into the refinement and value-added processes associated with fiber and grain.
Absolutely. Okay, so I hear a lot of times people talk about the number of facilities needed, you know, and number of facilities that are available. Can you, understanding that this is going to play a big role, or I guess the amount of tons processed plays a big role in probably the number of processing facilities. But, you know, when we're putting into perspective on a nationwide or even North America, what are we looking at as far as the need of facilities?
Well, you know, what I've looked at is I've looked at the number of licenses out there for processing. I've looked at the amount of tonnage associated with acres license versus what's actually available from a license perspective. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at what my 2030 demand is and then what that looks like in terms of capacity. So I don't have a straightforward answer to your question. But right now, the amount of supply in the system based upon that 230 plus 1,000 acres of supply, it doesn't really support the number of processors in the space right now. So I look for further stress in the processing industry because there's just not enough supply, fresh supply coming in. A lot of the supply is going to come in the form of stuff that's been in warehouse either from 2019 or 2020. And whether or not that's good and able to be processed is still to be seen.
There was a question here kind of along the same lines of what I just asked as far as number of processing facilities needed, but also addressing the ASTM and ICC results next year to improve demand for builders. Can you speak a little bit to the need there and what the lack of those standards have done to the industry or how they've prevented the growth?
Yeah, you know, anytime that you have a nascent industry, it takes a while for the standards to catch up. But standards are going to be the key to the evolution of the industry, right? Because if you can get hemp accepted as a building material, then people are more willing to build with it. If you allow it to be as an alternative source for automobile parts, for plastics and the like, then there'll be greater opportunities to include those in cars and other things. So the development of standards, while it's still nascent, is really, really critically important to the maturity of the market. And so I know that NIHC is working in this regard to help establish these standards or help at least influence the development of the standards. And they're really, really critical. And so in terms of construction in particular, there are some tests occurring right now, some developments on, you know, whether or not it holds up when compared to traditional concretes and the like, for example, on hempcrete. And so in that regard, it's holding up well, if not better. It's just more a matter of having those test results validated, confirmed, and then adopted in the standards. So now one other thing about standards is there's not only ASTM and the like, which are critically important, but also good manufacturing practices and good agricultural practices. And I think as the market evolves and as the myopic American industry opens up its eyes to see that there's all this stuff going on globally, that there's going to need to be these international standards adopted so that people can understand and engage in international trade. And in addition to that, those that set themselves up now to drive towards higher standards, a good manufacturing process, good agricultural process and the like, they will differentiate themselves, and that'll serve as a barrier to entry for other actors. And so by setting yourself up now, you're actually able to differentiate later, and then you'll be more competitive, not only in the US market, but in the global market as well. Uh-oh.
See, there we go. I put myself on mute. I agree. These are topics that come up all the time, and especially on the GMP, you know, and the certifications that are needed. Do you have, or does your organization have specific or referred, I guess, companies to work with for GMP certifications?
I do have a pretty extensive database. Okay. And I can make referrals. I haven't necessarily gone there to create a directory or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I certainly can help point people in the right direction. Awesome. And my reach not only is, of course, not only the US, but globally as well. So awesome. Yeah, there's some folks I can hook up.
Refer. Okay. So yeah. Real quick, with the FDA focused on CBD as a drug only from hemp, what do you see as the reduction as enforcement is enhanced?
Well, what's interesting about the FDA is that once they, the narrative is once they classify a product as a drug, then they don't have the flexibility to classify it as anything else. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually think that that's true. I think that the FDA is empowered to classify hemp in multiple categories, CBD in multiple categories, and not just a drug. But they're just unwilling for some reason to do that. And so there's opportunities as a food ingredient, as a supplement, as well as a drug. But right now they're holding firm on that. And it might be due to the interim leadership, and they're waiting for more permanent leadership to come on board. They may be deferring to Congress. I don't know what the intention is. But right now, that lack of clarity is impacting the growth and development of these other industries within the CBD space. And that's unfortunate. I did a recent analysis of regulatory uncertainty and its impact on CBD value. And as this biomass continues to accumulate and there's greater excess inventory than simple economics, right? Got to break out my sweater vest economics 101 lesson here. But when there's more supply than demand, prices go down. And when there's regulatory uncertainty, there's not going to be a whole lot of demand. And so it just creates an environment where there's either more supply or fewer participants in the space. And when I did an analysis using pricing that I got from Pan Exchange, I noticed that because of regulatory uncertainty and the lack of product manufacturing, the price, the value of the capacity in the processing industry had declined over a five-month period by $9.9 billion. And so that's the impact that a lot of this lack of clarity on the FDA side, for example, is having. That's the impact that it's having on businesses. $9.9 billion is a lot of money that could otherwise have been going towards product development, reducing costs in the retail channel, increasing productivity at the processing level above the 42% capacity that I mentioned, and then also getting more money into the hands of the farmers so that they can plant diversity of crops, increase their production of fiber, increase production of grain. So the lack of the insistence upon the FDA to only designate CBD as a drug has had this profound influence and impact on a negative way on the rest of the industry. And that lack of regulatory clarity is not just impacting CBD, it's impacting the rest of the industry on the fiber and grain side, because a lot of investors don't understand the story of hemp right now. And as a result, they see one headline, this is illegal, and then all of a sudden they think that fiber is illegal, or they think that grains are illegal. And so then as a result of that, they don't invest. And right now, the key to the maturity of the hemp industry is investment in that product manufacturing sector, and that's being impacted by the lack of regulatory clarity. So there's a lot to that question about enforcement and the FDA and CBD. It's a very, very complex issue, which has profound effects above and beyond what's going on in the CBD space.
Okay, so there's lots of questions that have come in, and I want to address one because this comes up all the time. In the construction and building space specifically, as you know, other organizations or companies have received certifications, say, in Europe and now are developing or building here, what does that look like as they've, let's see, here's a question from Glenn specifically is, what about the WTO technical barriers to trade and other international mutual agreements with respect to accepting accreditations achieved in other countries?
Yeah, now that's digging into a lot of detail right now. There's some aspects of that that I know quite well and others that that I don't and wouldn't profess to be an expert on. But in some instances, the U.S. respects the accreditation within certain industries. And they'll allow opportunities, you know, to be imported, let's say. On other issues, the U.S. regulators insist that all of the product accreditation, all these processes of accreditation, and all this comes from U.S. sourced suppliers, U.S. sourced goods, and all this stuff. Animal feed is a perfect example of that, where the there's all of this evidence associated with the benefits of introducing hemp into the animal food chain, which would then in turn enter into the human food chain. But the FDA is insisting that any study, any type of application for approval come from U.S. suppliers using U.S. hemp, using U.S. manufacturing, using U.S. herds, right? And so that insistence is impacting the acceptance of hemp as an animal feed. And then as a result, it's when we're in the middle of a hemp feed, but animal feed crisis like we are right now, this is actually impacting folks, not just in the cultivation and processing side, but it's hurting cattle. It's hurting folks that are processing the meats associated, and it's driving up food prices. So there's a lot of, this is the difficulty when it comes to either accepting and the challenges, accepting international accreditation and not, but it's really kind of a sector by sector thing. I know I didn't address construction and shift it over to animal feed, but it just demonstrates how complex an issue that can be and how sometimes insistence upon U.S. accreditation does more harm than good.
Yes. Well, and I'd love to connect you because these are types of conversations that come up often with a few of our members or people that are involved as they do have the accreditations. And so bringing them over is again, it's one of those like hurdles that I just don't understand.
You know, one thing on the construction side, I'm working with a group out of Hawaii, and they are able to target some development that don't require the local standards and the U.S. standards for construction because they're, say, on native lands or what have you. And so they're actually able to demonstrate on the construction side, the true capabilities of hempcrete and other building materials without having to jump through as many hoops. And so I think that by showing that there are examples that are, you know, have positive results in the construction arena in places like Hawaii, then that can be translated into potential and positive results throughout the U.S. construction industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, what about genetics? You know, this is a big topic that comes up also as we look at the scalability of this industry and how the majority of our seeds have been purchased from Europe or China outside of the United States. And understanding Europe is significantly smaller than we are, and our demand is going to be much larger than theirs. So I'm curious from your perspective where we're at as far as genetics and any opinion you have.
Yeah, so there are three basic groups of genetics as I understand it. There's the European genetic set, there's the Asian, predominantly Chinese genetic set, and then there's a North America set. And the because Europe has a long history in the industrial hemp space, their genetics appear to be more stable and there's less variability and they're more predictable. And so that's why there's so much demand. Then the Chinese, they're a little bit more variable. And so you're not going to get as much consistent results. And then on the North American side, a lot of the hemp genetics have been achieved through breeding out the higher THC side. And so they're more hybrid, if you will, in nature. And it's going to take several generations of crops in order to really stabilize the U.S. genetics or the North American genetic pool. And so that basically forces folks to default to the European ones. Now, what's interesting about this in my mind is that you may be able to have good success with European genetics in certain parts of the country, but that doesn't necessarily, especially parts of the country that are similar in nature from soil content and all this stuff, climate to Europe. But if you're in an area that's significantly different with a shorter growing cycle or with different, you know, cycles for the sun or the different climates, then there's going to be variability of results, even with the stable genetics coming out of Europe. And this is something that I think is often overlooked by cultivators when they go out and they purchase their supply. Where do I think that the genetic industry is going in the U.S.? I think that ultimately there will be a certified seed requirement, and that'll make it easier for the USDA and other regulatory bodies to monitor and regulate the cultivation industry and the propagation industry. But it's going to take a while for that that side of the industry to mature. And right now, it's still kind of up in the air from my perspective. It's going to take a while. Now, what's also impacting this is the fact that there's still all this regulatory murkiness, right? And the federal regulators are trying to control the industry rather than nurture and grow it. And what I mean by control is they're the federal regulators are having this difficulty trying to differentiate what's marijuana versus what's hemp. Mm-hmm. And so in this line of demarcation at 0.3% THC, it's really messing with the ability for federal regulators to regulate effectively. And so had they not had that line of demarcation, or had they not had the history on the higher THC side of prohibition and control, I don't think that the industry would be experiencing this level of control, which in turn is suppressing the growth and development of the industry, right? And so until there's a more nurturing policies associated with developing and growing the industry, it's going to be problematic. Now, what's interesting to me, and I went to Louisville, Kentucky with NIHC, and we talked to a lot of state Department of Ags and the heads of their Department of Ag program. And in my opinion, based upon my experiences there, there's a lot of development and a lot of support for industrial hemp growth at the state level. It's just not translating at the federal level. So you've got the state folks saying, hey, this is great. This is a good opportunity. There's opportunities for farmers, for all this stuff. But they're still, even at the state level, they're kind of handcuffed by the federal policies.
Which prevents a lot of movement, I'm sure, right? Because they're just unsure about what that next step is. And
yeah, it creates confusion, right? Absolutely. And whenever there's confusion, then people react a couple of different ways. They can either kind of freeze in place. They can take a more conservative approach and back off. Or they can do like some and just go for it and ask for forgiveness rather than for permission. You know, but
thank you to all of those who have done that. Thank you for paved the way to this point. So, yes. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. Well, we're coming right up on about an hour, Bo. What advice do you have? Or, you know, what really isn't being discussed that maybe we should be focusing on as an industry?
Well, I think one thing is the key here is this product manufacturing sector. There needs to be a greater emphasis on developing and deploying products into the retail channels. And by developing the product manufacturing sector, it'll provide greater and more stable funding and revenue into the processors, who in turn will give that to the cultivators. And so that's the real key there. But another thing that is in the narrative today is that there seems to be this cap on the CBD demand, right? And that that it only takes, you know, 30 or 40,000 acres in the U.S. of CBD production or CBD cultivated cultivation in order to support all of the demand for CBD. Now, I don't believe that. I think that there's more demand out there than what we could supply. It's just going to take the products getting into the hands of the consumer in order to really prove that hypothesis out. So I generally run these counter narratives, but it's data driven counter narratives. And so without the product manufacturing deploying new products, we won't truly understand what the demand is for CBD products. In addition to that, there's also a lot of opportunities here on the fiber and grain side. And I think consumers are willing to pay a premium to see hemp-based products into the retail channels and into their other products because of the aspects of sustainability, the aspect of climate, soil remediation and the like. So there's a lot of benefits that are often overlooked associated with the cultivation and production of hemp products that are really resonating with consumers. And so there's that pent up demand for fiber and grain as well. And it's just, it's being unrealized, or it's not getting out into the general public. And so that's why I appreciate Global Hemp Association for giving me the opportunity to tell the stories about these things and talk about the potential in a realistic and unbiased way. Right. And mm-hmm. so I just look at the data and right. But there's all these opportunities out there, and the story is just, while it's getting out, it's not getting out fast enough to drive folks into the market from an investment perspective and from a product manufacturing perspective.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to keep diving into this. I could go in deeper and deeper to a lot of different subjects, but I real quick want to ask before we get off two quick questions, your opinion on a co-op model, as we want to keep, you know, the processing close to the where it's being grown, and also the carbon. You know, how relevant is this carbon discussion when it comes to the work you're doing?
Two great questions. This morning I taught a class with the University of Nebraska, and I gave a kind of a hemp 501, right? It was a graduate class and an undergraduate class. And one of the questions from the students was, you know, is there economies of scale? And then what does that look like? And if not, you know, is it going to be small farmers? Is it going to be large farmers? You know, what's going on? And I thought it was a great question, very insightful from the students there. In my opinion, there's going to be these large scale production of hemp using modern farming techniques, mm-hmm. right? Combines, tractors. You know, I don't know how many cultivators I talked to that went from a 1,000 square foot test plot to 100 acres, and they assumed that they could harvest that 100 acres by hand. Right. For example. So they were just.
Right. Yeah.
and so you have this lack of knowledge of commercial farming techniques by a lot of the folks that entered in hoping to get rich, you know, and cash out, you know, on the big CBD craze. But at the very same time that there's going to be these opportunities for large scale commercial agriculture, and at 10 million acres by 2030. I think it's going to require some of that, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that small farmers are out of the picture, that they're going to be boxed out. I've been talking to a lot of economic development groups in various states and counties and cities that are looking very, very closely at this co-op model. And I think that there's a lot of viability from an economic development perspective to set up a hemp campus where you bring in your harvested goods, you dry it, you store it, you process it, you put it into a product manufacturing mode, and then you bring it to market. And a lot of these co-ops are trying to be located near the farmers so that there's not as much cost and carbon impact on the climate as a result of transporting the hemp great distances, right? So there's a real solid model associated with cooperatives in the hemp space. And I think that you'll see regional hubs being deployed as the market matures. And it only makes good economic sense, and it helps out the small farmers to develop that economies of scale that in order to compete against the large commercial operators. I think there's a lot to that. Relative to carbon, you know, carbon in terms of industrial hemp, it's like a hand in a glove. It fits very, very nicely. And I think that carbon credits and the economics of carbon relative to the hemp industry will prove to be and have the potential of providing additional income above and beyond just what's going on with the the deployment of products on hemp. And so there's a lot of opportunity there. And I think that is still in its nascent discussions, but it's important discussions to have, and something that all hemp farmers and processors should look at very, very closely. The carbon offsets and the credits and the revenue derived from that, there's tremendous potential. The more and more we go into this, closer to 2030 and beyond.
Awesome. Well, I'm really excited to keep diving in because, of course, everything you're talking about is exactly what excites me, is the opportunity around this and now really what it looks like to build those supply chains out as we are starting to see contracts and money or capital is starting to move in with the understanding and more education. And it's taking key people like what you're doing to present the numbers. And I really appreciate what you've got going on. And thank you again for everybody else that's joined and listened today. Alex, Drew, Ryan gave the best compliment. He said, and thank you very much, Ryan, for this. Supporting GHA and Mandy is the most reasonable price, $500 level class that you'll find. And so thank you very, very much. We really try to keep our content going. Bo, we're not even close to the reach you are as far as the number of times we're quoted or how many people we're reaching, but definitely linking arms with people just like you or the National Industrial Hemp Council is really where we're at and what our goal is. So if anybody else has questions or wants to get in touch, Bo, how do people reach out to you and your organization?
Yeah, I have a website, whitneyeconomics.com. And you can also contact me at Bo, B-E-A-U, at whitneyeconomics.com. And I try to be as responsive as possible because, it's just important and it's the right thing to do. And so, yeah, thanks for this opportunity once again. Really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Bo, I'm excited to see you next week and anybody else that's going to be out in DC for the National Industrial Hemp Council Conference. Please, give us a shout out. Let us know. There's lots of great things going on. And other than that, we'll see everybody next week on Tuesday. Nope, I guess Wednesday we go live again, Wednesday at 10 a.m. So after the conference, and I'm sure we'll go live at some point at the conference to say hello to everybody and kind of show off what everybody's doing. But besides that, Bo, thank you again very much. And thank you everybody else for joining. Have a fabulous weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bo.